Chapter 23. Benjamin Goldberg was the executor of his brother's estate. This estate consisted of a 40% shareholding in Goldberg Brothers Limited, a company which listed among its assets a brewery, four small hotels and a very large one, situated on the Marine Parade at Durban, 16 butcher shops, and a factory devoted to the manufacture of polony, pork sausages, bacon and smoked ham. The last products caused Benjamin some embarrassment, but their manufacture was too profitable to be discontinued. Benjamin was also the chairman of the board of Goldberg Brothers, and a 60% shareholder. The presence of an army of 25,000 hungry and thirsty men in Natal had increased the consumption of beer and bacon in a manner that caused Benjamin further embarrassment, for he was a peaceable man. The huge profits forced upon him by the hostilities both troubled and delighted him. These same two emotions were evoked by the presence in his household of his niece. Benjamin had four sons, and not a single daughter. His brother Aaron had left one daughter, for whom Benjamin would gladly have traded all four of his own sons. Not that the boys weren't doing very well, all of them settled into business very nicely. One of them running the Port Natal Hotel, the eldest managing the brewery, and the two others in the meat section. And here Benjamin sighed. But Ruth! There was a girl for a man's old age. He looked at her across the polished stinkwood breakfast table, with its incrustation of silver and exquisite bone china, and he sighed again. "Now, Uncle Ben, don't start again, please," Ruth buttered her toast firmly. "So all I'm saying is that we need him here. Is that so bad? Saul is a lawyer. No, is that so bad? He's a lawyer, but we need a lawyer with us. The fees I pay out to those other schmucks. He doesn't want to come into the company." "All right. We know he doesn't want charity. We know he doesn't want your money working for him. We know all about his pride. But now he's got responsibilities. Already he should be thinking about you and the baby, not so much about what he wants." At the mention of the baby, Ruth frowned slightly. Benjamin noticed it. There were few things he did not notice. "Ah, young people, if only you could tell them." He sighed again. "All right, we'll leave it until Saul comes back on leave," he agreed heavily. Ruth, who had never mentioned her uncle's offers of employment to Saul, had a momentary vision of living in Pietermaritzburg, close enough to be drowned in the tidal waves of affection that emanated from her Uncle Benjamin, caught like a tiny insect in the suffocating web of family ties and duties. She flashed at him in horror. "You ever mention it to Saul, and I'll never speak to you again." Her cheeks flushed wondrously, and fire burned in her eyes. Even the heavy braid of dark hair seemed to come alive like the tail of an angry lioness, flicking as she moved her head. "Oi, oi, 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 oi." Benjamin hid his delight behind hooded lids. "What a temper, what a woman! She could keep a man young forever!" Ruth jumped up from the table. For the first time he noticed that she wore a riding habit. "Where are you going, Ruth? You're not riding again today."
"Yes, I am."
"But the baby!"
"Uncle Ben, why did you never learn to mind your own business?" And she marched out of the room. Her waist was not yet thickened with pregnancy, and she moved with a grace that played a wild discord on the old man's heartstrings. "You should not let her treat you that way, Benjamin." Mildly, the way she did everything, his wife spoke from across the table. "There's something troubling that girl." Carefully, Benjamin wiped egg from his moustache, laid the napkin on the table, consulted the gold fob watch he drew from his waistcoat, and stood up. "Something big, you mark my words." It was Friday. Strange how Friday had become the pivot on which the whole week turned. Ruth urged the chestnut stallion, and he lengthened his stride under her, surging forward with such power that she had to check him a little and bring him down into an easy canter. She was early, and waited 10 impatient minutes in the oak-lined lane behind Gray's Hospital, before, like a conspirator, the little nurse slipped out through the hedge.
"Have you got it?" Ruth demanded.
The girl nodded, glanced around quickly, and took an envelope out of her grey nursing cloak. Ruth exchanged it for a gold sovereign. Clutching the coin, the nurse started back for the hedge.
Wait,
Ruth stopped her. This was her only physical contact, and she was reluctant to break it so soon.
How is he?
It's all there, ma'am.
I know. But tell me how he looks.
What he does and says, Ruth insisted.
Oh, he's looking fine now. He's been up and about on his sticks all week, with that big black savage helping him. The first day he fell, and you should have heard him swear, Lordy. They both laughed together. He's a real card, that one. He and sister had another tiff yesterday when she wanted to wash him. He called her a shameless strumpet. She gave him what for, all right. But you could see she was ever so pleased, and she went around telling everybody about it. She burbled on, and Ruth listened enchanted until... Then, yesterday, you know what he did when I was changing his dressing? She blushed coyly. He gave me a pinch behind. Ruth felt a hot flood of anger wash over her. Suddenly she realized that the girl was pretty in an insipid fashion. And he said, thank you. Ruth had to restrain the hand that held her riding crop. I have to go now. Usually the long skirts of her habit hampered her in mounting, but this time she found herself in the saddle without effort.
Next week, ma'am?
Yes. And she hit the stallion across his shoulder. He lunged forward so violently that she had to clutch at the pommel of the saddle. She rode him as she had never ridden a horse before, driving him with whip and spur until dark patches of sweat showed on his flanks and froth spattered back along his shoulders, so that by the time she reached a secluded spot on the bank of the Amgeni River, far out of town, her jealousy had abated and she felt ashamed of herself. She loosened the stallion's girth and petted him a little, before leaving him tethered to one of the weeping willows, and picking her way down the bank to her favourite log on the water's edge. There she settled herself and opened the envelope. If only Sean could have known that his temperature chart, progress report, house doctor's recommendations, and the sucrose content of his urine were being so avidly studied, he would probably have added a ruptured spleen to his other ills. At last Ruth folded the pages into their envelope, and tucked it away in the jacket of her habit. He must look so different without his beard. She stared into the pool below her, and it seemed as though his face formed in the green water and looked back at her. She touched the surface with the toe of her riding boot, so that the ripples spread and shattered the image. She was left with only the feeling of loneliness.
"I must not go to him," she whispered,
stealing the resolve which had kept her from him these past weeks, since she had known he was there, so close, so terribly near. Determinedly she looked down again into the pool and tried to conjure up the face of her husband. All she saw was a yellowfish gliding quietly across the sandy bottom, with the pattern of its scales showing like the teeth of a file along its sides. She dropped a pebble into the water, and the fish darted away. Saul. Merry little Saul with his monkey face, who made her laugh the way a mother laughs at her child.
I love him, she thought.
And it was true, she loved him. But love has many shapes, and some are the shapes of mountains, tall and jagged and big, while others are the shape of clouds, which have no shape, no sharp outline. Soft they blow against the mountain and change and stream away. But the mountain stands untouched by them. The mountain stands forever.
My mountain, she murmured.
And she saw him again so vividly, standing tall above her in the storm.
Storm,
she whispered, and clasped her open hands across her belly that was still flat and hard.
Storm,
she whispered, and felt the warmth within her. It spread outwards from her womb, the heat rising with it, until it was a burning madness she could no longer control. With her skirts flying about her legs, she ran to the stallion. Her hands trembled on the straps of the girth.
Just once, she promised herself, just this once more. Desperately, she clawed up into the saddle. Just this once, I swear it.
And then brokenly,
I can't help myself. I've tried. Oh, God, how I've tried.
An appreciative stirring and hum of comment from the beds along the wall followed her as she swept down the hospital veranda. There was urgent grace in the way she held her skirts gathered in one hand, in the crisp staccato tap of her pointed boots along the cement floor, and the veiled swing of her hips above. There was unrestrained eagerness in the sparkle in her eyes and the forward thrust of her breasts beneath the wine-coloured jacket. The wild ride which brought her here had flushed her cheeks and tumbled her hair glossy black down her temple and onto her forehead. Those sick and lonely men reacted as though a goddess had passed them by, thrilled by her beauty, yet saddened because she was unattainable. She did not notice them. She did not feel their hungry eyes upon her, nor hear the aching whisper of their voices, for she had seen Sean. He came slowly across the lawns towards the veranda, using the stick awkwardly to balance the drag of his leg. His eyes were downcast, and he frowned in thought. Her breath caught in her throat as she saw how wasted was his body. She had not remembered him so tall, with shoulders gaunt and wide, like the cross-tree of a gallows. Never before had she seen the bony thrust of his jawline, nor the pale smoothness of his skin, faintly blue with new-shaved beard. But she remembered the eyes heavily overscored with black brows, and his great beaky nose above the wide sensuality of his mouth. On the edge of the lawn he stopped with feet apart, set the point of the cane between them, with both hands clasped over the head of it, and he lifted his eyes and looked at her. For many seconds neither of them moved. He stood balancing on the cane, with his shoulders hunched and his chin raised, as he stared at her, she in the shadow of the veranda, her skirt still held in one hand, but the other at her throat, fingers trying to still the emotions that fluttered there. Gradually his shoulders straightened until he stood tall. He hurled the cane aside and reached both hands open towards her. Suddenly she was running over the smooth green lawn, into his arms, trembling in silent intensity, while he held her. With both arms around his waist and her face pressed against his chest, she could smell the man-smell of him and feel the hard muscle of his arms as he enfolded her, and she knew she was safe. As long as she stayed like this, nothing, nobody, could touch her.